Welcome, everybody, to another Comics Are My Religion podcast for ComicAttack.net. I am the comic book clergyman, Jeff Jackson, and this month I got a chance to talk to English professor at Baylor University, Greg Garrett. Greg is author of Holy Superheroes, Exploring the Sacred in Comics, Graphic Novels and Film, The Gospel Reloaded, Exploring Spirituality and Faith in the Matrix, We Get to Carry Each Other, The Gospel According to U2, and most recently, The Other Jesus, Rejecting a Religion of Fear for the God of Love. We had a lot to talk about, so let's jump right in. I'm here with Greg Garrett, English professor at Baylor University and author of all kinds of books, most notably Holy Superheroes, which is a book on comics and religion that we cover here on Comics Are My Religion. So how you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a beautiful night here in Texas.
Oh, man, here in Georgia, too. It's pretty fantastic. So, and most recently, Greg has published a book called The Other Jesus, and we're going to talk a little bit about that a little bit later. We're going to focus the conversation, of course, on comics, but we do want to hear about what all you're working on. So, so first of all, why don't you tell the listeners out there kind of who you are, what you do, what your passion is.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. Well, my name is Greg Garrett. I'm a writer and teacher. I teach full-time at Baylor University, and I write fiction, nonfiction, and memoir. And the nonfiction that I write is primarily focused on the intersection between religion and culture, or spirituality and culture. And so I've written several books about the ways that religion and culture interact with each other and different things that we can learn from books, from movies, from music that are in some way spiritual or philosophical. And so those are some of the things that I do. I also do a lot of public speaking and a lot of teaching, and I'm trained as a theologian and a preacher. I trained at the Episcopal Seminary of the Southwest in Austin.
Fellow Episcopalian.
Yep.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, awesome. And so you've done some work. I mean, your work definitely spreads across all kinds of genres, music. I mean, you wrote a book on The Gospel According to U2. You know, it's all over. You do movie reviews. I mean, you're really one of the top culture and religion writers in the United States. And so let's talk a little bit about your work in comics and what drew you there. What got you interested in comics to begin with?
Yeah, well, what got me interested in comics was comics, and I've been reading comics since I was, I don't know, maybe 10, and with the exception of a short period in the 90s. Where I didn't much like most of the comic art and most of the stories. I've been reading comics pretty steadily since the early 1970s. And my brother and I used to sort of divide up the Marvel comics. He'd collect half, I'd collect the other half. In those days, back before sequential stories, we didn't have a whole lot of interest in DC. We'd pick up the occasional story, but they're just... For us, they didn't have the kind of dramatic interest because everything was one of those one-and-done stories, and none of them had any impact on the next thing that followed. But we were really drawn to the sort of sequential and episodic kind of drama that was taking place in comics. And it was one of the few places that we were getting things like that. We didn't get to watch a whole lot of TV, although our family did watch MASH. And I remember having the same sort of feelings about those comic book characters, as badly written as they sometimes were, as I did about the really good TV characters like Alan Alda's character on MASH. Long before I knew why I was interested, I was being drawn into their lives because in that kind of sequential drama, you know, a long-running TV show, long-running comic characters, book series or film series, we get to know characters better than we do any other kind of drama. And So there was something really powerful and compelling about the stories we were seeing, even though sometimes, you know, they were a little bit more smash and crash and blowing up things than they were drama. They were more melodrama than anything else. But I've always loved that kind of storytelling, and I'm really drawn to things like TV's Lost and Friday Night Lights and other really good TV series where you get that kind of deep knowledge of a character. And then the second thing that has always drawn me to those characters is that there was this larger-than-life quality about it, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about this. But there's this very real sense that the adventures they're having and the powers that they have, there's something unearthly about them and otherworldly about them. But at the same time, there's the recognizable human drama. And so, you know, Superman may be invulnerable to bullets, but he can still get his heart broken.
Yeah.
And so there's something sort of compellingly human about the characters at the same time as there's this kind of cool and crazy power set that I don't have in my own life, and as I look around the house, don't see any evidence of. Kind of the best of both worlds. You know, the fantasy or science fiction kind of genre stuff that is supernatural, and then the very real sense that we're dealing with like human lives and human emotion.
Right, right. Well, and going back to what you were saying about the DC characters, even, I mean, I think these days in modern comics, there's been a lot of work done to kind of try to humanize some of those DC characters. That was one of the things that didn't draw me growing up about the DC characters. I thought they felt so lofty. It was the Marvel characters that had the more humanity. You know, Spider-Man couldn't pay his bills. You know, those kind of things that draw that. And I think that really speaks with what you're talking about there. Just that sense that we all have of the connection between this world and some other supernatural world, whatever that is, and sequential art kind of does that in a way. Tell me a little bit about what is it about that media that is that maybe does it in a way that other forms of medium can't quite get at. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think. Well, there's a really interesting marriage of different kinds of communication. You know, I'm a writer and a novelist, and I write stories. And you get one kind of experience when you read stories on the page. And I write screenplays, and I teach screenwriting. And there's a different kind of experience when you watch action take place. And what happens in a really good comic book is that you get the images and pictures that communicate and sort of make your brain work in different ways. And so it's a way that you can kind of stimulate your brain in a more powerful way than just about anything except, I don't know, maybe movies do it because you've got all of these different kinds of stimuli at once, but you're not reading while you're doing that unless you've got your titles and subtitles. So I think, you know, just sort of theoretically speaking, what's happening there is we are doing different kinds of cognitive work when we read a comic or graphic novel than any other kind of story experience that we have. And, you know, I can't speak for anybody but myself, but I find it, like, incredibly immersive. As somebody who's been reading comics for a long time, I find it the easiest kind of reading now. It's just sort of, I pick up a book and go straight into it. And it's sort of sad to report, but I'm unwilling to read a novel unless I really sort of have to. And I was saying earlier that you know, I've been talking about The Hunger Games because the new film is coming out. And so I was rereading Hunger Games tonight. But as good as that story is, I was just going, wow, this is kind of hard work.
Right. Exactly. There's something about that visual that really draws us in, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's deceptively simple. I mean, you know, you can read a comic in a couple of minutes, or you can dwell on every aspect of it, and it can take an awful long time. So it's one of those things, like any kind of media, the more you know about it and the more you appreciate it, the better you read it.
Right.
And the more you get out of it.
Yeah, Yeah. So tell us how you developed or how you came to want to write a book about the connections between comics and religion.
Well, early on, I worked on a book with one of my best friends, a guy named Chris T. And Chris is one of the sort of godfathers of the emergent church movement. He and Brian McLaren were kind of there at the birth of that movement here in America. And Chris is an old friend of mine. He's a Baylor grad. And although I didn't teach him, my ex-wife was in his class. And so he and I got to be good friends. And it was sort of surprising. I was not a particularly religious person at that time, and the idea of being friends with a Baptist pastor was fairly low on my list. But we shared all this passion for different kinds of popular culture. Mm-hmm. And when the first Matrix film came out, he asked me if I would write a book on the Matrix with him. And we did, The Gospel Reloaded, and it was one of the bestsellers for our publisher that year. And I found it to be really stimulating. It was one of the things, out of a number of things, that brought me back to faith after a number of years of being out of the church. Just sort of having to wrestle with this whole question of what do I think Jesus is? What is this whole God thing? What are we meant to be doing? Mm. And, you know, that sort of grew out of The Matrix, which is, you know, a beautiful example of pop culture. It's, you know, it's artistic, it's thoughtful, it's exciting. And there are enough kind of hints that its makers were trying to draw some threads to other cultures. You know, you've got a Messiah figure or a Buddha figure or a Jesus figure in Neo. And all of those things seem to be intentional, little hints that are saying, well, why don't you think about this for a little bit and see how this opens up your experience of our story. And so after Chris and I had worked on that together, he suggested that I should write a book about comics, and that was something that was of interest to me. I was reading a lot of comics at that time, and a good short discussion of philosophy and spirituality in contemporary comics, and it came out with NAV Press and did pretty well with them, not exceptionally well, but pretty well. And then they let it go out of print. And a couple of years later, I'd written a couple of books for Westminster John Knox, the Presbyterian publisher. And they brought the book back into print, and we did a revision of it that brought us through the second Batman movie and a couple of the kind of major comics events. And so that most recent edition of the book is sort of revised and updated with some new material, and also kind of a new appendix where I picked some new comics, particularly for people who are not deep into reading comics, that might be interesting to them both philosophically and spiritually.
What I like about that list, I was thumbing through it today, and you have such a wide variety of books that you chose to include in that list. I mean, everything from What Will Watchmen is in there. And, you know, which isn't necessarily a religious kind of book. You've got things like Kingdom Come, which have some bigger threads there. And did I also see The Killing Joke? I think is on that list. So I mean, you know, you have some really wide varieties of different books in there that I think are really. That most people wouldn't necessarily see as having religious themes. What were the thoughts behind picking some of those?
Well, one of the things that's really important to me, and I very rarely write about things that are intentionally religious. You know, so I will never write about the Passion of the Christ. There is no need for me to draw people's attention to the religious themes in a religious film.
Right.
But as somebody who is both a practicing theologian and a cultural critic, the thing that sort of makes my passions come together is the places where people are making meaning from literature and culture, mm-hmm. and may not know the meanings that they're making. So like all this stuff that I'm doing today where I talk about Hunger Games, I'm talking, you know, not just about oppressive governments and about reality television, but also about the recession. Mm-hmm. You know, because it seems to me that one of the things that's going on there is that this is an allegorical way that we can understand a society where young people are being told that they're going to have to compete with each other tooth and nail to feed the people they love. You know, that's, it's a broadly allegorical reading, but it's one that is one of the things that's going on there and one of the reasons why it resonates with people. And so those things that I chose, first, I chose them for the most part because they weren't explicitly religious. There were a couple like Kingdom Come that do have, you know, clear religious content, but for the most part, I wanted to say, you know, what do these other things, what do these other books have to teach us about good and evil, about ethics, about the idea of a savior, and even if they don't have anything explicitly religious in them, what are some things that they can teach us about how we should live our lives and some ways that we might understand our own faith traditions better? And the other thing that was sort of true about how I tried to choose these was I tried to choose broadly so that people were not being, say, that they're not all Marvel books, they're not all DC books. Some of them are mainstream, some of them are very sort of off the beaten track. Nice. One or two of them, I wonder if anybody else but me has ever read them, because I've never run across anything else written about them.
Like what?
Let's see. John Muth's, let's see, is it The Passion Play? I forget.
Oh, right. Yeah, I haven't read that.
But it's one of those that's it's a beautiful book, and it's so unusual that you wouldn't think, you know, well, I don't know that this would get a broad audience, but there's a lot of really powerful stuff going on here. And then the other thing that I tried to do in putting that appendix together was just to assume that anybody who had read that far was actually looking at this list because they thought that maybe they would get something out of it. And so for each of those books, I tried to talk about which of the broad themes they dealt with, you know, the heroism, vigilantism, the world to come, you know, all of those sorts of things, so that you could know that if you pick up, you know, this Superman graphic novel, you know, these are the four or five sort of broad spiritual themes that it might help you understand a little better.
What are you knowing that your passion is really kind of seeing things that are or making the connections between things that are clearly removed from religion but have religious connections that we can draw from. Where do you see the role of graphic novels that are really talking about religious themes in more unique ways? I'm thinking of books like Craig Thompson's books. Have you read Blankets or Habibi? You know, what's the role that those play in the genre in terms of this connection?
Well, I am interested in them in the same way that I'm interested in anything that we would think of as identifiably Christian art.
Right.
When you get something that succeeds as art, that for me is the first thing. You know, Blankets is a really beautifully drawn and a beautifully told story. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that each of us has seen things that are sort of demonstrably Christian, but, you know, their desire to preach has overwhelmed their ability to tell a credible story. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about Christian art of any kind, the first thing that I ask is that the art work. If it's not a good story, if the art is crude, then nobody's going to be interested in reading it. And so I think something like Blankets is really useful in the same way that somebody like U2 or Switchfoot is really valuable.
Right.
Because they are proof that somebody can be, you know, a first-class artist, you know, at the top of his or her field and make really good popular art, and do it in such a way that you don't overwhelm the art with the message. Mm-hmm. My own sense, and I look at my own work, my writing of fiction, as well as the nonfiction that I do where I write about other people's work, And this is the great and tragic irony, is that you won't communicate with anybody who doesn't already believe the same way you do, unless you write a good song or tell a good story.
Right.
So I think something like that, or something like Kingdom Come, you know, where you have a character who's based on, the father of, what's his name, Alex Ross.
Right.
The pastor character.
Right.
Comes across as he ought to come across, as this person who is a deeply good person. He's having a crisis of faith because of the events in the story. But it's beautifully drawn and beautifully written. And so even though there's an explicit religious dimension there, we never for a second think, you know, all he wants to do is to convert me to his way of thinking. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear that he wants to tell an amazing superhero story, like the superhero story to end all superhero stories.
Right.
And what better medium for doing that than an apocalyptic story about the end of the world?
Mm. Yeah. What are some comics? I mean, it's been a while since you've even done the revision of Holy Superheroes. What are some things between that time when you did that revision and now, where you're seeing some good theological work being done in a mainstream comic?
Well, theological may be a little too much to ask.
Yeah, that's true.
definitely spiritual.
Okay.
One of the things that I've really liked from the last year or so, there were a couple of books that came out, I think Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, in the wake of the temporary death of Johnny Storm.
Yeah.
That were just beautiful books about grief. Mm. And as somebody who's written a book about the theology of grief, mm-hmm. They don't do theology, but they did like the different elements of grief and how we grieve and how we comfort people who grieve incredibly well.
Right.
That's one of my favorite things from the last year or so, is just this incredible spiritual value of companionship. Mm-hmm. And particularly I think about, and again, I think it was a Spider-Man book, although again it could be Fantastic Four just because there was that Spider-Man shows up and basically he and Franklin Richards, right, Johnny Storm's nephew, have a conversation for the whole book. And it's it's about how we miss the people who are gone and how we blame ourselves sometimes for the fact that they're gone. And it was just, an incredible example of companionship, what those of us who have done chaplaincy work, mm-hmm, think about, being present with people as they grieve and being a non-anxious presence for them. You don't have to say the right thing, but you have to be there, mm-hmm, and be willing to walk with them. And that's, I think, one of my favorite things from the last year. I'm really liking a bunch of the stuff from Captain America in recent years. Pretty much everything since Bucky returned.
Right.
And that whole idea of the Winter Soldier and of somebody who was sort of made into an evil creation, mm-hmm, and how do you atone for the evil you've done in your life. Mm-hmm. I think that Captain America over the last couple of years has done some really incredible work on good and evil and human choice, and sort of allowed us to dramatically explore those things with a character who's essentially good but did bad things. And I think a lot of us can identify with that. We haven't done violence, we haven't assassinated people, but it's the whole thing that the Apostle Paul talks about, which is, I know what the right thing to do is, and yet I can't seem to bring myself to do it all the time. Mm. It's just at the heart of the human condition. Mm. And then another of the things that I've really liked in the last few years is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And so season 8 and now season 9, they've done some incredible stories. And I think, again, I'm thinking about community and how we walk alongside each other and the whole question of, are we good or are we evil? How do we know what choices to make, and how do our choices determine who we are? Mm-hmm. Those are a couple of things that I've really liked. And then some of the ongoings. I really like Hellblazer, John Constantine. And he is, at least in the current issues, going back to hell And it doesn't get much more, you know, sort of religiously cosmological than that. And I guess the other ongoing that I really like is Brian Bendis's Powers. And there are times that he writes too much, and his characters have a tendency to sound exactly alike. But I really do enjoy the way that he sort of deals with some of the things that are going on in our culture at a given time. And with this whole question that's also talked about from the very beginning of Spider-Man, what do we do with power? You know, what responsibilities do we have if we're powerful? What restrictions should we accept on our power and freedom? So I enjoy that book as well, and I'm so excited that's begun to come out again on a semi-regular basis.
Yeah, that's great. Well, tell me a little bit about some of the recent comic book movies that you have seen, some good and maybe not so good ways. You know, I haven't seen the recent Ghost Rider, for instance, but I've heard some really bizarre things that kind of came out of that movie, and a lot of that had to do with the audience and the production that was where it was made and all of that. But but tell me a little bit about some of the comic book movies that you've seen, maybe some of these continuing threads.
Well, two that I talk a lot about in schools and churches are Iron Man and Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And Iron Man, I thought, was tremendously well done. First, it's incredibly topical, dealing with, as they point out in the film, the fact that the United States is the largest importer of arms in the world. And that in some sense or other, we have an economy that, if not dependent on arms sales, at least benefits from it in an amazing way. What does it mean to be merchants of death? The other thing that I really liked about Iron Man that we don't typically see in an action-adventure film, because usually the characters are pretty static,
right?
We've got a character who transforms during the course of that first Iron Man movie. Mm-hmm. The Greek word that we use for this is metanoia. And often when people preach, they are talking about the idea of people transforming. It's a Greek word that, as you know, is translated in our New Testaments, in the Bible, as repentance. And that is such a limiting way to think about metanoia. It's not just that Tony Stark stops doing certain things, but that he starts doing other things. Metanoia is about, you know, making a 180-degree turn, so that instead of being, you know, an indulgent arms-dealing playboy, he's an indulgent arms-dealing not-so-much-anymore hero. And so that was something that I thought was incredibly powerful. There's a spiritual and religious dimension for those of us that really believe in the power of human beings to change. And then Dark Knight, I mean, it opens up on so many levels that it's almost impossible to talk about. But the whole idea that there could be human darkness of such intensity as represented by the Joker,
right?
That just in and of itself scares us to death. And one of the things that movie does is it gives us explanation after explanation. We're looking for an explanation for what made the Joker like he is, so we can push him out of our heads and not have to deal with him anymore. And although I really like The Killing Joke, which is that origin story for the Joker, in some ways it's limiting because it's a psychological origin. What The Dark Knight tells us is that human evil is just a part of who we are. And some of us get a lot more of it than the rest. But, Alfred's story about that bandit that he pursued during wartime, that line that he says, you know, some men just want to see the world burn. It makes us deal with the very real fact of human evil and not compartmentalize it, you know, by saying, oh, well, he's got a brain growth. Or, oh, he had a horrible family of origin.
Or his family was killed, and right, yeah, exactly.
And then the other thing that the Dark Knight does that is so powerful is it says, okay, human evil is real, and so is human good. And the experiment that the Joker sets up, where you've got a commuter ferry full of regular people, you know, your average Joes and Josephines, and a commuter ferry full of hardened criminals. And you say, one of you is going to have to kill the other, or I'm going to kill you all. And, you know, the story is set up, and it's so suspenseful. But to have one of those convicts, you know, take the detonator and say, you know, I'm going to do what you should have done, and throw it out the window. And there's a surprise moment there. But with any good surprise in a story, it's followed almost immediately by that, of course. You know, it's that there was something in us that said, I knew that human beings were also capable of this. And, you know, so when the Joker's going, well, any second now, it's going to happen.
Right.
I love the fact that the movie also acknowledges that there is that possibility for goodness. And, you know, in our faith tradition, we talk about grace. And about God's grace allowing us to be different than we might otherwise be given our natural human inclinations. I love that idea that we can choose the good rather than the evil, and that's I think one of the things that does really well. As far as bad ones, I haven't seen any of the Ghost Rider ones because I cannot stand Nicolas Cage in a role like that. Green Lantern was so bad I could barely finish it.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm not even sure what happened in that movie.
Well, and I mean, and I think that's a good example of one that was really trying to. It was where the special effects got in the way of that underlying story. I mean, where Iron Man had all of that. Same kind of CGI,
yeah.
and all of that kind of stuff. There was depth of character of Tony Stark. I mean, exactly what you're talking about. With Green Lantern, I think that's a great example of how
yeah.
it was all glitz, it was all shiny, it was all that. But they didn't really give you any sense of depth for who Hal Jordan was as a human being, but just kind of thrust him into this role.
I saw it on the plane either going from or to England. And on the same flight, I saw the last Transformers movie, and they were so incredibly similar.
Right.
You know, just all of this CGI, it's like, I can do this, and so I will. And, you know, I don't have any inherent interest in watching imaginary creations battle. You know, I care about human drama. I care about human emotions. And that's not to say that you couldn't make a good Green Lantern film, but that certainly was not it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that leads me to my next question, which is, you know, upcoming this summer we have the Avengers, you know, the continuation of Tony Stark's journey, really, along with
yeah.
you know, Bruce Banner, the Hulk, who is the kind of archetype of living with monsters inside of you and how to juggle
oh, yeah.
who you are and the anger and all of that stuff that kind of. Bubbles up inside of us, and then and all of those characters in sharing one screen, which is if you've seen the latest trailer, it's full of beautiful CGI moments, you know. And then you also have The Dark Knight Rises, where mm-hmm. a continuation of what you were talking about earlier. What are your expectations there?
Well, they're pretty high.
Yeah, me too, unfortunately.
I feel like they're both going to be good stories and well done. I feel a little more sure about Christopher Nolan because he almost never lets me down. The only thing that concerns me where the final Batman film is concerned is I'm not sure how you improve on what you've done before. Mm. There are so many incredible things that happened in Dark Knight that the bar has been set really, really high. The nice thing about Avengers is, you know, some of the films have been blockbusters, some have been sort of middle of the road. And then the Hulk, you know, never seems to work out at the box office. And so, you know, we may pitch our expectations a tiny bit lower just because we don't have six blockbuster films leading us in there. But I am interested in both of those. And the thing that for me is really interesting, just based on what I do, is that, you know, those are the few days a year, you know, when something like that or something like The Hunger Games or something like the last Harry Potter film come out, where people are actually interested in knowing what people who study culture think. And it'll be one of those fun occasions where I get to do a lot of interviews and kind of do some reading of things and you know, sort of help people reckon with the messages of those stories.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, to give Joss Whedon a little bit of credit, I mean, I think in his TV shows, he has time to develop some of those characters. My fear is that because of his lack of producing big summer blockbuster movies like Avengers, that he's not going to have the time to develop the characters that he's actually pretty good at once given the chance. And
oh yeah,
so. So that will be interesting to see. And I'll be interested to read your reviews about both of those movies and Spider-Man and the rest that are all coming out this summer. It's a good time to be a comic book fan. That's definitely true.
Yeah, so. It is. And it's always really interesting because every summer people, you know, the media will ask me, well, is this it? Do you think this is the high point? And, you know, they've been saying that every summer for years now. And the truth is, as long as there are still some comic book films that are successful at the box office and seem to be doing pretty well, and so they interest top-flight talent, then this is going to go on because it's a natural kind of way to tell stories. One of the things that I've been saying about The Hunger Games is, you know, the same thing that I was saying about Harry Potter. Even though the superhero world, you know, has some correspondences to ours, it's not our world, you know. It's like I was saying earlier, you know, I can look around the house and there are no bat poles and no one's flying past my window. And because of those elements of unreality, I think actually in some ways it's easier to tell a really good story with some deep themes. Because what C.S. Lewis used to say is that in fantasy, a fantasy story allows you to creep past the sleeping dragons of reason. And I've always loved that line. It's something that, of course, you know, he was thinking about in terms of his own Narnia books, but he was also thinking about it in connection with Tolkien's fantasy writing and with the science fiction stuff that Lewis was interested in. You can tell a really good story in science fiction or fantasy, and people are not going to put up the same kinds of walls to it if it's got topical themes in it, just because they won't immediately recognize it as their own. And that's one of the really cool things about storytelling in those genres. You can tell your stories about anything you're passionate about and not worry that, say, a liberal or a Republican is going to react differently to the story you're telling because they're going to think of it as a partisan political issue, let's say.
Mm. Yeah. Why now? Why are these movies and, you know, comic books, why are they... What is it about us right now as a culture that we're, I mean, these characters, and of course, you know, you can say, well, with movies, the things like CGI have gotten to a point where they can actually tell these stories and make them look real and all that kind of stuff, but I'm getting more at what is it about our human makeup right now that's really calling out for these larger-than-life stories?
Well, that's one of the things that I try and deal with in Holy Superheroes, the idea that you know, we're drawn to these particular tales because they help us to make meaning of some difficult elements in society. One of the biggest ones is that we live in an increasingly fragmented and chaotic world, and we can react to that in different ways. One of the things that is a reaction to chaos in the world is increasing fundamentalism. And that's religious fundamentalism or political fundamentalism, kind of a circling the wagons and saying, you know, well, let's hold on to everything that we can still hold on to as tightly as we can because the world seems to be changing so quickly. And so when we live in a world like that, it makes us really uncomfortable. And even if we get excited about things, you know, this whole internet meme this week that somebody with a cell phone in Africa has more access to information than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. You know, as excited as we can be about the possibility of change and what the future is going to be like, the future is still the future. And the idea of change is still a little bit frightening to us. And so one of the things that I think superhero comics do is they offer us that comforting illusion that there is somebody in charge and somebody looking out for us. You know, somebody like a Superman or a Spider-Man, that there are these heroes who are making it their mission to kind of corral the chaos and to make sure that, you know, whatever happens, we're going to be okay. In religion, we have that idea that God is with us, but it's a little bit harder for us to visualize. And so when we see these stories about heroes in the on the silver screen or in our comic books or in our popular culture of any sort, there's a comfort that we get from that, that consciously or subconsciously we're recognizing that you know, somebody is looking out for us, because a lot of the time it doesn't feel that way. I think the other thing is that there's also this sense that human nature might be essentially good rather than essentially bad. One of the comics that I recommend in the appendix, and it's one of my favorite books where spiritual and religious values are concerned, is Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale's Superman for All Seasons. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that I think it's Lana Lang asked in this book is, why would somebody be Superman? If you had all the power in the world, why wouldn't you use it for yourself? Mm-hmm. And there's this really powerful sense that, you know, he is innately good, not because he's from another planet, but because he's from this planet. Because he was raised by good people and taught good values. And when we look at him, when we look at Daredevil, when we look at Spider-Man, when we look at all of these characters who could go out and do anything they want to, the fact that they choose to do good rather than evil is, I think, something that's of real comfort to us, because, frankly, we don't always see that in our culture. We look at these bankers who bankrupted us all, and we think, well, this is typically what people do when they get power put in their hands. And so I think that's one of the comforting messages that we get from it. And then maybe the other thing, and you were asking me about Avengers earlier, one of the things that I love about the group books like Avengers and Justice League is that they can give us some information about what it's like for really different people to live together. You know, if you look at the Avengers or you look at the X-Men, you look at the Justice League, not only are these people of different races, but often they're from different species.
Right.
They may even be from different planets, you know? And we know how hard it is to live in community where people differ from each other. But when you see people like in the classic DC continuity, Hawkman, who's sort of a conservative defender of, you know, traditional values, and Green Arrow, who's an ultra liberal sort of hippie, you know, who shoots people, and you know, they're here in the same space, and they argue about issues, but ultimately they pull together around, you know, a common set of values and a common mission. For those of us that work in the church, you know, that's one of the things that's most important for us, is a compelling narrative. Right. The idea that we can still pull together around a common mission as a people of faith, or as a nation, people in a community in a time of crisis. And when we look at them and we see, wow, they're really different. You know, that person can teleport and that person has scales. And yet, you know, when the time comes, they help each other, they work alongside each other. Hey, that one saved the other one's life. Mm. That's kind of the third thing that I think is a really compelling narrative that we will get consciously or unconsciously when we take a look at those stories.
That's great. That's great. Well, tell us about your latest book, and maybe what you're working on in the future.
Okay. Well, I've got a book that's a little bit over a year old. It's called The Other Jesus. And it's a book that grew out of a bunch of writing I've been doing over the last 4 or 5 years in a blog for the Christian Century, which is a magazine. And a number of people had been asking me to sort of explain how I'd been outside of faith for many, many years and then came back to faith, and how what I was like now and what I believed now was different than what I believed before in the tradition that I grew up in. And so The Other Jesus is a book about what it means to be a thoughtful and faithful follower of Christ in the 21st century. And that book came out last year. I have just finished up a book on religion and politics that's coming out as an ebook from Pathos Press this month.
Wow.
And it is looking at, well, it's actually very different than what I imagined it was going to be when I started it 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to be writing some sort of voter's guide, you know, and looking at all of the different sort of issues. Okay, here's abortion, here's war, here's gun control. And I really didn't end up doing that. What became more and more interesting to me was, how can faith be something that helps to mend the broken fabric of our culture as opposed to pull it further apart? And Senator Danforth, the former Republican senator from Missouri, preached a sermon at the graduation of the seminary where I got my Master of Divinity, in which he talked about the importance of reconciliation. You know, a lot of times when religious people get involved with politics, they're involved in a particular social issue. You know, I'm working on getting the death penalty abolished, or I'm trying to get people not to get abortions, you know. And those are really divisive issues, and the truth is that good people can fall on opposite sides of those issues because of the way they read them. And when Senator Danforth said that, and that's been 2 years ago, and that sort of reshaped the way that I thought about writing this book, what are the really positive things about religion that can bring us together and get us to think about things from our faith perspective instead of from a partisan political perspective? Because a lot of times I think we're political animals first and religious and faithful people second. And so that's a book that's coming out, and it'll be the first full-length ebook from Pathos when it comes out later this month. And then I'm finishing up a book on post-9/11 American culture, which is kind of the culmination of everything I've done in all the different fields. So I read television, I read movies, I read music, I read cartoons. I do a lot of political and theological conversation. And the idea is basically that we are very different people today than we were 10 years ago before 9/11. And in most of the ways that we're different, we are worse off spiritually, politically, culturally, economically. And the thesis of the book is a very sort of basic cultural critical thesis. I'm looking at all these cultural artifacts as a way of examining the conversation that we've had with each other over the last decade about things like torture and internment and preemptive war and surveillance and other things like that. And so it's not a long book, but it's a big book in that I'm writing some really important things and using pop culture to kind of carry the weight. And that's been really interesting. The one thing that I carry away from that, and I'll just pass this along to anybody thinking about writing a book about culture, it is a whole lot harder to write about episodic television than just about anything else.
Really? Why?
Because there's so many hours.
So much to watch.
So much to watch. So, for example, when I get the DVDs for 11 seasons of CSI, that's a lot of television. And you know what I discovered is, like, you know, I had not even finished the first season before I discovered, okay, well, this is what CSI is about. Every episode of CSI is going to contain these things, mm-hmm. and it's going to contain these things for the next 10 seasons.
Wow.
And yet, you know, if you're going to call yourself a scholar, you've got to have that whole realm of preparation. So I tried to be very selective. And there are a lot of things that I was simply unwilling to watch. One of the chapters in that book is called Bread and Circuses, and it's pretty pertinent for this Hunger Games stuff as well. But I was writing about the rise in reality television and what it says about us as a culture, that we would rather watch these sort of hyper-dramatic lives instead of pay attention to our own lives. And the really interesting thing is that the boom in reality television comes pretty much right after 9/11, and you find a number of the reality TV producers talking about how they see it as a direct correlation. It's a way to take people's minds off of the stress, the tension, you know, the fear. So much easier to watch Fear Factor than to feel fear. So that's been really interesting. That is at a publisher right now, and I'm hoping we'll have good news on that anytime now. And then looking ahead to the future, I've got a novel that I'm shopping. I've got a couple of books that I'm in the early stages of thinking about. One is on Augustine. I'd like to write a contemporary book about why Augustine still matters. And then this is not the least bit. Well, I guess it is cultural now that I think about it. I've done a couple of books of memoir. And I imagined that I was absolutely through writing about my life. But I'm getting ready to get married, and I'm taking on a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old.
Wow.
And mostly raising a couple of kids already, I'm discovering that I have to reorient my life. And just to give an example, in the last 3 weeks, I spent 5 days speaking in Louisville, 5 days speaking in Charlotte, a couple of days speaking at Villanova in Philadelphia. And so, you know, I'm sometimes away more than I'm home. And you can do that with a 26-year-old. But with a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old, I mean, you know from your own kids that you need to be there with them. And when you're away, you're suddenly on the outside of the family dynamic and trying to claw your way back in.
Well, so, that's one of the good things about Skype is that I can sit in my living room and have a conversation with you.
That's a good point. Well, and I mentioned that I think that this is a cultural project because I know there are a lot of parents who feel like they work too much. And I was reading something in The Guardian about a new book about what people who are dying are reflecting on. And in the top 5 things that people say, one of those top 5 is, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. And I thought, wow, that's really pervasive. And so I'm working on another book of memoir that will be about a year of my life where I try and reorient my life to be home with my family. And I'm imagining it will be something like the Year of Living Biblically, or Julie and Julia, you know, a book that's kind of drawn from daily journal writing. And so what's really interesting about that is I have no idea of knowing where it will end up.
Cool.
Naturally, I hope it's a happy outcome.
Yeah.
But
I'm sure it will be.
That's another project I'm thinking about.
That's fantastic. Well, where can people find you online?
Well, probably the easiest place these days is to find me at Patheos, P-A-T-H-E-O-S. I write for them weekly. And if you just wanted to Google Greg Garrett and Patheos, it'll bring up a whole store of articles. I write about culture and religion and politics for them. And so those are things that I'm going to continue to be passionate about. And then the books, of course, you can either find them at your local bookstore. They can order them if they don't have them. Or our friends at Amazon are always happy to sell you something.
That's right. Books and otherwise, right?
Yeah.
Well,
barn tools, I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Greg, I cannot thank you enough. You know, between your hours of watching CSI and your kids that are coming into your family and all of this stuff that's going on, it's really nice of you to take some time to talk to me this evening. So I do appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for the time, and all my best to all the folks that are following you.
Awesome. want to give a big thanks to Greg for giving me some of his time to chat. You can find all of his books on Amazon.com, so check those out. You can also check out more Comics Are My Religion articles over at comicattack.net, as well as all the other awesome stuff that we do over there, like the other podcasts, Contest of Champions Live, the Comics Dispatch, Tales from the Water Cooler, and discussions with Decapitated Dan. We also do great reviews, awesome columns and features, and you can interact with all of us from comicattack.net on our forums by going to comicattack.forumer.com. And finally, if you have any comments or questions, be sure to follow me on Twitter at FR Jeff Jackson. That's Father Jeff Jackson. So thanks a lot for listening. Have a great day.